1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about disinformation, and we were also talking about the manipulation that comes online when we're searching for particular terms. We were talking about how many of our political opinions are shaped by the coverage of newspapers and media outlets that depend upon Google searches and Google words and things of that nature. Well, a long time ago, somebody made the claim that Google and search engines were a threat to democracy. At the time, many people laughed at it, dismissed it. But here we are in the middle of what some would call a war around information, especially as we're trying to get facts and figures around COVID, and as we're seeing the erasing of Black history around arguments dealing with what we are calling critical race theory. Somebody who was on the front line and was well ahead of the curve in dealing with these matters is our guest. Her name is Sophia Noble. She is an associate professor at UCLA, co-founder and co-director for the Center of Critical Internet Inquiry. She's the author of the book, Algorithm Oppression, and she's a homegirl from the town. So welcome to the show. And I think this is the best time to have you on the show to talk about this book. It was ahead of its time.
Yes, you know? Dude. Yes. Thanks so much for having me. I'm a super fan of Davey D and a longtime listener of KMEL back in the day and Hard Knock Radio and all the work that you've done over the years to just bring truth and knowledge to our people. And so I just want to say thanks so much. It's a great honor to get to talk to you today.
Well, thank you. Algorithms of oppression. I don't think there's a better way to really describe it.
Right.
And I gave a pretext, but let me just bring it home a little bit. There's many people listening. Big shout out to people like Chaney Turner and others who are routinely kicked offline, finding themselves in what we call Facebook jails, finding that when they say an inkling of something that's political and it gets somebody uncomfortable, they're removed. While, you know, we're seeing rampant racism, rampant sexism, rampant homophobia in many places allowed to fester on these internets. So let's talk about your journey to doing this book, because it starts off with a primary target for this, which is Black women.
That's right. That's right. I have to say that it's been a journey. 10 years I've been studying the effects of large digital media platforms in our society, especially as they harm Black people, vulnerable people, poor people, children, women, LGBTQ people. I think even at the time that I started thinking about, you know, calling this book Algorithms of Oppression, you know, it was an outgrowth of my dissertation when I was getting my PhD, and I finished that in 2012. So, I started doing this work around 2010, and I was stunned that over and over when I did searches on keywords like Black girls, Latina girls, Asian girls, the whole first page of Google search results would be pornography or almost exclusively pornography or like hypersexualized content. And of course, that begs a couple of questions. One, who is the imagined searcher that Google has in mind when they want to serve up these results, right? Who do they think is looking? And that, of course, affects what we get. But then also, what happens when we Black girls, Latina girls, Asian girls look for ourselves? When our children look for themselves, what are they met with? And also, how come you don't have to add the words sex or porn? We're just synonymous with that, right? And of course, this is linked to this long history of hypersexualization of women and girls of color in the United States in particular, but of course beyond that. And, you know, I thought this was a really important matter to unpack, because mm-hmm. every time I asked people who were experts, I asked professors and researchers, I said, you know, why do you think this happens? And they'd say, oh, well, that's just because that's what everybody's looking for. And I felt that was a completely inappropriate and insufficient answer. So right. I set out to try to understand and write a book about what search engines are, how they work, and ultimately help the public understand these are large-scale advertising platforms. They're not right. knowledge portals. They're not public libraries. They're not a replacement for an education. Right. And that's kind of what my work has been about for the last decade.
You know, for people who don't fully understand, because I think when you're saying you're searching, they're thinking that if David D puts in black girls, that he's searching for black girls in pornography, which is why I got the results. But as you laid out in your book, I type in black girls and there's the algorithms already put like suggested things. So before I even finish typing black girls, it will have black girls, big booty or things like that, right? So it's not a thing of me as a consumer looking for something nefarious, but it's really a situation where the actual company, the $1 trillion company, or in this case, Google, is suggesting to me, if I type in black girls, I must be looking for black girls in all these pornographic references.
Absolutely. And, you know, people think that the kinds of results they get are custom to them, because this is one of the things that the tech industry tells us, is that the way we experience the internet is a reflection of all the things we've ever done on the internet, you know, the cookies, the tracking, the kind of surveillance that happens of us. And so if you get those results, it must be a reflection somehow also back on you, right? What you, right. what your values are. And of course, that's not true. I mean, I was looking for, I'm a black feminist. I look for all kinds of things about black women and girls, and trust, you know, pornography is not even in my top 50 things that I'm looking for.
Right.
So, you know, I think this is a part of the way that the companies, you know, they obfuscate what their technologies are, and they push responsibility back to the public. Mm-hmm. And this happens over and over again when Google is, you know, asked why is First Lady Michelle Obama, when you do an image search of her, why for a, you know, quite a while, a photoshopped image of her with a gorilla face, right, would come up on the top of the search. And, you know, this, of course, of being an incredibly racist, derogatory stereotype about black people. And, you know, Google would disavow any responsibility. But then when a high profile thing like that happens, then they kind of have to own, it's our algorithm that served that up. And what they do many times is when there's a huge public relations issue, they'll delist or they'll kind of downrank certain types of results because they're PR problems. But fundamentally, the logics of how their technology works is that those who can pay the most to optimize content in their 24/7 AdWords business model are able to optimize and get the you know, certain keywords linked with their content. And of course, the porn industry has more money than any industry, probably right next to the tech industry. So, you know, this is one of the reasons why we got these results for a long time. Of course, now, you know, Google has responded to my book and other critics, and they kind of take our work like a big book of tickets, and they open them up and they go, somebody go fix this. And they do. But that doesn't stop the kinds of things you talked about earlier from happening, which is people are constantly getting shadow banned. Certain words, certain hashtags will, you know, if people use them in their posts, might not be as visible. And investigative journalists stay on top of this and are constantly reporting out these kinds of problems, which of course, typically are around progressive political ideas in our society.
And, you know, the other thing that you point out in your book, and we're talking with Sophia Noble, author of Algorithm Oppression, if you're just tuning in, you did a little digging and you talked about the fact that many of us think that, oh, this is a computer thing. It's computer generated. And we forget that these computers are programmed by individuals. And you pointed out, I forget the gentleman's name. It's slipping my mind. But he wrote this scathing anti-diversity letter that went viral. Yeah, it went all around and got a lot of cheering and, you know, and retweets. So he represented this whole ideology, like too many women are in the workplace, too many Blacks, all, you know, totally against the things that we should be fighting for. You have within the internet a number of folks that are, I'll call them MAGA type of people, you know, Make America Great type of Trumponian type folks who work in this industry. And what I got from, you know, the parts that I read is that we have to be aware that they're behind the programming. So there are certain things that they can do, can't do, or may, you know, just turn the blind eye to. And in my personal opinion, I think they actually, you know, there are a lot of people who sit up there and go, oh, Sophia's posting again. Let's make sure her stuff doesn't really get a lot of traction. Dave just said something about the political scene in Israel. Let's ban that. You know, Joe down the street said something about, you know, Black people are criminal. Let's make that go viral. So let's talk about the people behind the programming and what we need to be aware of.
Yeah, you know, it's true that there are, you know, these cases that have broken through in the media. I mean, the first person you talked about here was James Damore, who was a programmer who worked on Google search. He worked on that product. And, you know, he did write a kind of a scathing screed that got many, many, many people at Google excited and supportive behind that screed, which basically claimed that women and people of color were intellectually inferior and not biologically capable of being good programmers and making good technology. And so a lot of really harmful kinds of claims that, of course, are patently false. So, you know, you have certainly people who have many different kinds of political ideologies working within the Valley. I think one of the things that Silicon Valley has done that's been incredibly dangerous as a kind of industry beyond the individual makers who, of course, bring all of their politics and their points of view and their, you know, ideologies to bear in their creativity and in their technology making. There's no question. Mm-hmm. But I think the Valley generally and Silicon corridors around the world, they really are invested in like libertarian ideologies that disavow any kind of encroachment upon freedom, right? This is the language that they use in the Valley, which is that their technologies are agnostic and apolitical, that tech is just a tool, that it is not value laden, it has no politics. And of course, that's just patently false. I mean, we have 50 years of people writing critically against these ideas and proving over and over again how different kinds of software and systems and employment practices and venture capital funding patterns are all discriminatory and full of kind of anti-civil rights orientations. So I think we have lots of evidence now. And, you know, of course, I'm always trying to add to that mountain of evidence, mostly to show that the lack of regulation, the total lawless way, and that includes avoiding civil rights laws. I mean, we see, you know, the case against Facebook, where it was actively engaging in not showing employment ads to people of color or not showing housing ads, right? So we know that the companies, they don't even know they have to comply with things like civil rights laws. So there's, I think, a lot at stake when we have such an outsized sector controlling so many dimensions of the public good, of education, of the resources. And this is a really important moment for a reckoning around that. And I just think the politics of silence and pretending to be apolitical have been as damaging as the right-wing politics that also are embedded in many of these kind of actors.
Let me ask you this, Sophia Noble, our guest. I won't say I'm pushing back, but I want to see if maybe we can contextualize this a little more. Because you said that in the Valley, you know, the language, and I think, you know, the language which is carried over and people hold it as a belief, the common folk, that it's apolitical, that it's, you know, that they don't know that they have to be cognizant of civil rights. But you also point out in the book that they, you know, that they very much are. So when you're looking up Black girls and you're getting all these pornographic results, our friends in the Jewish community, when they started to get the anti-Semitic results, they were able to get disclaimers put along their searches, right? And get it changed. Obviously, when you go to certain countries, they put the restrictions on there. So, you know, depending on what country you're in, you punch in a word, you're not going to be able to see it. So China has restrictions, you know, other countries, you know, Germany, I think you pointed out in the book as well. So are we talking about they only become political if there's a political force that can make them, or they're just willfully, they're selective. So they're going to do for our Jewish brothers and sisters, but they're going to keep the anti-Blackness going. You see what I'm saying?
I understand exactly what you're saying. Okay. So, you know, in the book, I give the example of the Anti-Defamation League writing a letter to Sergey Brin, you know, asking why is it when you do searches on the word Jews, almost, again, the first handful of results for many years were anti-Semitic, Holocaust denying websites. Right. And the ADL, you know, even, but this is interesting because, you know, the ADL puts this pressure on Google, and Google writes back to the ADL and says, oh, well, that's not actually our fault. That's just because of how people search. But we'll put a disclaimer up, and they do put the disclaimer up because the ADL exerts a tremendous amount of political power in our society, and certainly on the Jewish founder of Google, Sergey Brin. So, you know, there's a response, but the response to me also underscored a major problem in some of the ways organizations also respond to these companies. The ACLU has also had this problem, which is to say, they're like, oh, Google said it's not their fault. Okay. And we'll take a disclaimer, you know, instead of what I try to say is, if Google's not responsible for its own products, who is? Google's actually responsible for the search results of its own search engine. So I think, as is Microsoft, as is, you know, Yahoo, and any other search technology. So the question is really, to what degree do these organizations, I think, fight for allowing these companies to have an outsized say in framing the problems? And of course, we know. In fact, I think The Markup just did a very important series of stories about certain kinds of phrases that are tied to Black Lives Matter and, you know, justice for Black people in the United States, again, being shadow banned or suppressed. Right.
So can you explain what shadow ban means for our listeners?
It's a way that the algorithm will just make the content less visible. So instead of blocking your account, it will just, if you're using certain keywords, it will throttle your content from being as visible. So maybe it won't go viral, or it's not going to be seen by as many people.
I thought they did that on Facebook with Trump a lot, you know, with certain accounts. Like, if I know when I mentioned his name, it throttled. So I stopped mentioning his name. And I know a lot of folks, when they start to say white, you know, that's the one that I think most Black people see, they get throttled. So now they have different ways in which they refer to, right, you know, white folks. You know, they'll use two V's, or, you know, me, I just don't use the word at all, you know, just to avoid it, period. But those are realities that we deal with.
Yeah, I mean, part of what's happening here is that the there's kind of two dimensions of content moderation or in managing the information environment that the social media companies in particular are using, but also search, which is they have software that is constantly scanning for certain words, and that is designed to somehow flag up, typically to human moderators, that there's a problem, they should take a look at it and either, again, suspend an account or throttle a post or, right, take it down. And they do this now, in fairness, for some things that are very important, like it's illegal to traffic in child sexual exploitation, right, or child pornography. So there are many different kinds of photo DNA and other types of software that they use to screen for that, because that has to come down. There are though political ideas, and of course, where we've seen this so much, especially on Twitter, is when Black people and on Facebook are reposting or resharing some way that they've been attacked or trolled, right, in a racist way. And when we do that, we are often flagged and taken down for criticizing the racism that we experience rather than the person who's doing the racist aggression being taken down, right? So this is where the software screening and even the moderators are so kind of incapable, underprepared to even discern what they're looking at
Is it
because they're just
undertrained?
using keywords.
Is it undertrained or intentional?
Well, I will tell you that I've seen content moderators do live screening, and like my head went to the desk. It was like basic things you would learn in an intro African American studies course about history and society that they actually couldn't even understand, or in an Asian American studies course where they didn't recognize something that was clearly racist propaganda. Because it wasn't like specifically targeted at an individual, right? So it wasn't you, Davy D or XYZ. It was a meme or something that uses humor in an extremely pejorative and a racist way. Software and often people who are doing moderation outside of the United States, which you want to remember. And Sarah Roberts, my colleague at UCLA, wrote a very important book called Behind the Screen that's all about the content moderation industry, and it's fascinating.
Oh, wow. I
If
gotta
you are
check that
into
out.
it, you should read it. But one of the things that we learned from her work, she was the first person 10 years ago. We've been homegirls for a long time because 10 years ago, she was writing about content moderation when no one even knew content moderation was happening, like I was writing about search. And one of the things we learned from her work is that much of the moderation isn't even happening in the local context. So if you have people, for example, in another country moderating around racism or sexism or homophobia, transphobia in the United States, and they don't understand the cultural cues and context, how, they can't actually understand racist propaganda. It's hard because it's a combination of humor, words, visuals. Those things software can't understand. You'll always need people to make sense of it.
So,
And of course, we're not in control of that.
in other words, if you don't have the cultural cues, if I'm sitting here and I'm talking to you and you go, Dave, the Warriors stink. And I go, Sophia, you a damn
I
fool,
would
right?
never say that. Don't you dare. Steph Curry's listening. I rebuke that.
But if I say, you're a damn fool for that, somebody in another place would be, oh, he just called her a fool. That's a strike,
Exactly. You
And
got
then
it.
if I turn around and say, next time I see you, I'm pushing you down the stairs. Oh, he just threatened violence. And so, whereas everybody would get it, somebody else is like, he called her a fool and then threatened to throw her down the stairs, remove the post. And then, I'm using that as an extreme
You see
example,
this?
but the so
Yeah, I mean, this happens in the real world. That's right. Yeah, I mean, listen, do you remember when the brother in, I think he was in Louisiana, he went to Popeyes. It was like Houston or New Orleans somewhere, and he was like, y'all, I gotta go blow up this bathroom. And then the workers called, they thought he was actually, but he's like, no, I'm actually gonna go poop and blow it up. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's like, right. It's like how there are certain kinds of colloquial ways that we speak. And of course, you know that African-American vernacular English is not understood by software screeners or by content moderators, because our words, our ideas, they're shifting, they change, they're in response to real-time things that are happening in the popular culture. You know, that the,
and it's
the
also
tech can't keep up with that. Yes.
It's also tone, even though that's we're right. writing, there's the expectation, if I go, you a fool for that, you should be able to hear the tone, even though it's a written thing, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Let me ask you this, and not to deviate too much from what you've written about in the book, because I got a couple of other questions around that. To the content moderation, the fact that we've had for years, and actually more than years, because I can go back to the 90s being down in Silicon Valley with Chuck D and Jesse Jackson. So I go back far back when they were pushing, you know, and I, you know, we first had a website for diversity. It would seem like at this point in time, they go, you know, we have this diverse planet. We have this diverse society. Let me go to these colleges and find people who excelled in African-American studies, Africana studies. Let me get the folks from Latina and La Raza studies and make sure that they are part of the moderation, since it's such a big thing, so that they understand culturally what's happening. I mean, even if they get the conservative folks and church people and all that, why don't they fill the ranks with, you know, quote unquote, lay people who have these understandings, people like yourselves and others, to come in there and be a part of the process? Why haven't they gone there?
You know, it's a really good question. I mean, I will tell you that content moderation work is typically low paid contract work. It's brutal. It's psychologically and emotionally traumatizing. There are people who are even reporting out neurological damage from the kind of trauma that they experience in doing that work. It's mostly been hidden work for decades. It's been offshored and put in places where vulnerable people do that kind of work. And I think that, and I, you know, poor people, working class people doing this kind of work, it's contract work. So, you know, one of the things that is so difficult is that that type of work is not valued the way white collar software engineering is valued in the Valley. So, but see, to me, this is part of the problem, because the propaganda, the disinformation, the kinds of things that move through these social media platforms is the product. It is what makes them money. And it's the thing where they skimp the most in terms of supporting those workers. Those tech workers are tech workers, and they are precarious workers, like Amazon warehouse workers. They're those kinds of precarious workers, but those are the people who make the entire engine work. So the question is, when people of color and women and working class people do these jobs, why aren't they made more valuable when they are so critical to the entire operation? And I think that's part of the challenge of like organizing tech workers and making these linkages around the labor conditions, the value of that work, compensating it, giving people benefits, giving people breaks, using technology in ways that spares the harm that comes to people. I mean, you would not believe the things that people see, whether it's like, you know, beheadings. I mean, I remember seeing an executive from YouTube on Good Morning America a couple of years ago, and he said that YouTube alone has 400 hours per minute of content being uploaded, 400 hours per minute. So there's no amount of human labor force that can go through just YouTube and figure out what's happening in these spaces around the harm. And of course we need deep expertise. I mean, this is one of the reasons why such powerful racist propaganda can really flourish in a site like YouTube, because there's nobody looking. There's nobody looking until people like me and you, everyday people, your listeners, see something and they're like, what the hell? And then they flag it. Well, you know, so we do the moderation work ourselves.
Right. But this becomes the point. Somebody like you When you're starting and you're doing these searches and you saw what you saw with Black girls, you should have been empowered to say, let me go tweak this so that we can change that. There should have been somebody on the inside to be able to do that. And with all the technology that is, you know, paraded around and held up as an example of quote unquote American excellence, there should be an understanding and a commitment to say we could figure out how to make the impossible possible. You know, if it's 400 hours a week, we can figure out how to do that, you know, and do it correctly. I just don't believe that is incapable of them, you know, them being incapable of doing that.
Well, I'll tell you the reason why. There's a couple major reasons why it doesn't happen. The first is the sector, especially the social media and search companies, they disavow their responsibility for the content that moves through their platforms. They use Section 230 of the Federal of the Communications Decency Act of the FCC policy to not be responsible. Now, the reason they don't want to be responsible is because they don't want to be considered publishers, because publishers like radio stations and TV stations and other media companies are responsible for what happens over the airwaves, right? You know this. Okay. I know you know as well as anyone. Okay. So if they disavow their responsibility as publishers and they push it back on the public and say, well, the public's just doing whatever, then they don't have to be accountable. And that is huge in terms of the responsibility. It also would mean they would radically alter their business model, because what they're selling are our eyeballs and our time that we spend in these platforms to advertisers. Our time and energy is the product. So they need to have as much stuff in there, or us making things, user-generated content, to be able to create value that they sell to the advertisers. If they slowed down the process, think about the old, back in the day, you know, if you wanted to get a letter to the editor published in the, you know, Chronicle or the LA Times, you know, you had to write it and send it in. It got viewed. It took a minute. It didn't automatically get there.
Right.
You know, the engagement model, the way that Silicon Valley makes money is really through more content being viewed. And so they could slow down that process, of course, maybe not as slow to the letter to the editor in the old school newspaper, but of course they could slow down the process. Instead, what they've done is acculturated the whole world, you know, to instant gratification, instant posting, no review, no accountability. And, you know, there are consequences. And I think we're living through many different kinds of disparate and harmful consequences to that.
You mentioned about Section 238. Is that
230?
230. Yes. But didn't Europe, or at least the UK, switch things up and be like, yo, you know, you're responsible for some of the stuff. Yeah. So they just did that, I think, maybe a couple of months ago. Right. So
yeah, the EU has definitely been out front in terms of regulating large technology companies. There's no question. And, you know,
but
you mentioned Germany.
But they've adopted. They had to adopt. Right.
They did. They do. Yeah. And, you know, even in Germany, you know, for years in Germany and France, it's illegal to traffic in anti-Semitic and neo-Nazi and Nazi paraphernalia and ideas. You know, in countries like Germany and France, they have much more of a reckoning with the Holocaust than the United States has had with its Holocaust of African and Indigenous people.
Right.
So, you know, they're more attuned to their Holocaust than we are to ours. And I will say that there, the companies face huge millions of dollars of fines if they are found trafficking in Nazi anything. And so their orientation, though, is they don't have free speech laws. They don't have the First Amendment in those countries. They have a different model around speech, which is you can speak, but to the degree that your speech creates active harm against others, we have a responsibility to the society and to the collective of communities as much as we do to the individual. They have a more balanced way of thinking about speech, not speech at all costs. like we have in the United States. Now, this is also a very narrow interpretation of the First Amendment that the Valley uses, because, and this is where another great book Marianne Franks wrote called The Cult of the Constitution that recently came out. And she explains in this book how the First Amendment, for example, which the platforms hide behind as a way to let anything go, also, the First Amendment guarantees the right of assembly. Right. And when certain people speak in ways that drive you off the platform or hamper your ability to talk in your community, that also is a violation of our rights. But people leave that part of the First Amendment on the table. You know, they don't want to pick that part up and say, well, now we have to be accountable for trolling that happens in our platforms, or calls for an insurrection against the US government. You know, they disavow all responsibility for how their platforms get used in these ways.
Sophia Noble, let me ask you this. There's so many questions. I might have to do a four-parter with you.
Come on, let's do it.
You know, full documentary. In your book, you talk about some of the harms that happen in communities because of the search results, because of that. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that? You know, when we start to get into the profiling of neighborhoods, and I think you even used the word redlining. So, you know, and you type in Oakland, crime ridden, you know, dangerous city, type in Berkeley, you know, fun loving, free speech, even if it has the same crime rate. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, perceptions and how it harms all of us with these algorithms.
So one of the things that I think is, this is a complex, I'm going to try to get at the headlines because I want people to really understand part of what's happening here. So I mentioned again that these platforms are large scale multinational advertising platforms. That is fundamentally what they're doing. They're selling ads to their clients. That's how they're making their money.
Right.
So these platforms are engaged in all kinds of like surveillance advertising, which means they are susceptible to all kinds of people and companies who are interested in manipulating ideas and having Oakland misrepresented, okay, in the way that San Francisco is not. We all know this. So there's kind of this surveillance advertising where people can really optimize and manipulate ideas and people, and we lose control over how we are. So somebody could, I'm always waiting to get silkwooded, you know, by the Valley, by Google or somebody else, you know, where they're, I can remember, in fact, talking with my friends who are data scientists and computer scientists. They're like, the worst thing you could do, Sophia, is take on these companies because they could destroy you. They could just put all kinds of nefarious, wrong, horrible things, tie them to your name, and your life is over. And we know that this happens because people have committed suicide over misrepresentative things being linked to their names. We have seen people lose jobs. There are very real consequences. People don't get jobs. They don't get into school. They have law enforcement and judges and lawyers using Google searches as evidence in court. Right. Okay. Yeah. So this stuff is real serious in terms of the consequences. And for me, you know, knowing how fraudulent so much of this is, it's devastating to imagine that a judge would use a Google search on DVD to make a decision, right? Or on me. So I think
they actually did. I was in a court case and testified. And sure enough, you know, the prosecutors looked up and brought up something. Yeah, they searched and, you know, and tried to attribute me to a bunch of things. I was an expert witness in the case. It was very interesting. And the judge was like, we're going to have to discount his testimony because blah, blah, blah. It was crazy.
See, this is not appropriate. I mean, this is not an appropriate use because anything can go into a search engine, including all kinds of fraudulent things, which always are going up into the internet.
And you know what it was they took a quote from an article that where I wrote and I quoted somebody, and then they attributed that quote to me. and made that a character thing.
Decontextualized.
And yeah, decontextualized. And it was like, did you say Sophia needs to jump off a cliff? No, I did not say that. You know, but you know, they wouldn't let that get out. It was a really interesting experience. And then when I looked and I saw that the context in which it was is that, you know, how some people will highlight something juicy to get your attention. So somebody had re-quote the article and use that as the headline. And the next thing you know, and really what it was like NYPD are a bunch of dip, you know, with the pejorative word. You know?
Yeah, right.
And that became the thing. And yeah, it was, you know, sitting there like, wow.
That's unbelievable. And that is, that happens every day in courts around the country, right? Yeah. And imagine all the people who are not Dave, you know, who don't have any juice or ability to defend themselves or even articulate. Yeah. And the lawyers, I mean, I talk to lawyers and they're like, Sophia, everything you're telling me is killing me because I use Google searches all the time in my cases. And I'm like, you guys stop. This is inappropriate. This is not evidence, you know, in the way that you traditionally think of evidence. You have to really get forensic to understand if something is being fairly used and if it's even authentic and real. And so
because you can manipulate all that
because you can manipulate this so much, because again, there's no accountability. There's no frameworks, there's no guardrails around this. So this surveillance advertising kind of, project that is the way most of us experience the internet is very dangerous in our society. It's remaking the way we live, the way people experience opportunity, the way for opportunities are foreclosed. I'll give you an example that people don't ever think about, which is everybody's going to Zoom school during COVID.
Yeah.
I teach at UCLA. We have things called learning management systems, which is like where we put up all the readings and you know, post your assignments and things. Young people use these things all the time. Well, they also keep a lot of analytics about students. You know, I try to tell my students all the time, hey, listen, don't tell me that you, and don't tell any of your professors that you did the readings. I can see you haven't logged into the Moodle in 6 weeks. You know what I'm saying? So like, they don't know that all the ways that they're being tracked and surveilled. Well, there are also these analytics that are used to kind of profile who the best students, who the best possible students could be. These things get, these profiles, these digital profiles get made in all kinds of different systems from the time kids start school. And I worry about those kinds of things, that we're going to see a generation of kids who can't get into college because of some type of surveillance technology that was used, you know, it was sold to parents and administrators as good to keep kids on track, but it actually gets used as a data point in giving them an opportunity or not.
Right. So we have a similar thing too. You know, and so, yeah, you can go on there and be like, Jane, you know, we put up the reading. You only looked at the book for 5 minutes and the book was 300 pages. And so now you're here asking why you got a C in the class versus an A. And if I really want to be that person, I can go back and go, you know, on October 3rd, Jane, you only looked at the book for 5 minutes. And then you answered one question, you know, it gets that detailed. And
it does.
So the surveillance is, you know, I mean, as an instructor, I'm, you know, much more nuanced and understand and, you know, but I've seen professors, you know, my colleagues go, you know, this is what, this is what the science says. And they go with that and people suffer. And I usually tell them, you know, don't, you know,
I know. I tell my students all the time how all these things work, because I just don't want them to get ensnared or just to be naive and not know. But I think this changes fundamentally for my students, the way in which they feel the freedom intellectually to explore. I mean, instead, now they're so oriented around the score, the number of points, you know, right? The what the rubric is, instead critical of learning.
Critical thinking is gone.
That's right. And, you know, we have a responsibility right now to stop Truly. I mean, I look at something like you're at San Francisco State, I'm at UCLA, we're at public schools, public California universities. Now, here we are. I can tell you in the UC system, we get about 4% of our funding from the state now. All the rest of it, you know, we have to raise in different ways. And one of the things that is so concerning to me is how can we be public school instructors and we have Silicon Valley and Silicon Beach? We have seven of the 10 most well-capitalized companies on planet Earth are tech companies. And all of our public goods, like public schools and public universities, public health, public media, are failing, are struggling. People are not getting paid well. There's fewer and fewer resources. And this is where Silicon Valley has also failed the people of California by not paying taxes, by taking all the municipal tax breaks, by compounding the issues of gentrification. By destroying the public good, in essence, by not paying their fair share, and then letting universities subsidize training the workforce, right? While they put so nothing back into the system. And to me, this is so immoral and unethical. And as a public worker, I will tell you, I'm incensed. Then by creating these crises, they of course come in, rush in with their tech solutions. Like, here you guys, you need a Moodle because you don't have time to grade papers. Well, you know, it's like, are you kidding me? You know, if we had the taxes going into the system, we would actually have the resources to hire our grad students and hire more professors and pay people a livable wage in these big cities in particular. And the systems could be thriving. We'd also drive down the cost of tuition, right? And fees for students. So it's a systems problem. It's like there's problems with the software, but there's problems with the system too, and the way that this sector works, you know, lawlessly and you know with impunity. I mean, they take and give very little back and convince us that they're doing us a favor. And I'm not buying it. And I'm relentless about doing more and more research on this because I think some of these practices just have to be made illegal, and our policymakers really need to understand what's at stake.
You know, as we close out, and I'm gonna have to have you come back, you
Okay,
know, because
anytime.
we still were just on the surface of the book, folks. But you know, this is a brilliant scholar.
Thank you.
Sophia Noble. So, you know, we're going to take advantage and pick our brains and have, you know,
Anytime.
conversation. But, you know, we've often talked about the automation of the assembly lines and what that meant for workers, you know, how Detroit went full automatic and, you know, and our grandfathers and fathers lost their jobs. And you know, we sat back and we cheered and said, well, they should have learned how to code and you know and got tech savvy. But now we're seeing in those other professions that is now starting to be automatized. I'm using that word, but it's really artificial intelligence. We don't need you to actually code now. We got a computer that does that. So you who was able to afford $5,000 a month rent, who showed up to Oakland and thought you were saving our city by, you know, your money in fancy coffee shops, you're out of a job too. You're about to be, you know, a paycheck away from destitute. And that's something that absence critical thinking, absence the ability to see long term or to even understand, as you laid out, how systems of power work and systems of exploitation, you know, allowed to thrive, you'll miss that, you know, as well if you get too arrogant because you have a couple of hundred dollars in the pocket and they go, you know, money is no longer useful. Do you have Bitcoins or do you have a digital wallet? Well, we got a lot.
We have a lot to talk about, Dave. I mean, you are right that AI, you know, the way that Hollywood imagines AI, like the Terminator and these kind of, you know, frightening scenarios, killer robots. I mean, that is a really narrow conception of AI, and it's probably a dangerous one because it distracts us from really understanding the things you're talking about, which is how simple tasks are being automated by computing. Narrow AI is definitely becoming more and more a proxy for human judgment. And I will tell you that if you take anything away from my book, it's you'll see how faulty the logics of so many of these AI systems are that to replace the kind of critical thinking, the nuance, even the spirit and the emotion that human beings bring to decisions. I mean, that is something we don't want to just toss out. We need to put a higher value and a higher premium on our humanity rather than thinking crude algorithmic systems are superior to us. I mean, it's one of the most important things I say in the book is that at the moment we have this possibility for a multiracial democracy, the passage of the Civil Rights Act, and you start to see a trickle of people of color and women into the management and decision-making positions in our society, you have the rise of the belief that computing and computers can make better decisions than human beings. And you have a reconsolidation of power by the elite into controlling computing industries. So these are things that are just, this is why we need these histories and we need to understand because they will help us understand our future.
That's a good note to land on. Please read the book, Algorithms of Oppression. Folks, I think it's an essential book that everybody should read. The way that you read a driver's manual, the way you have to read it because we are engaging in these systems every day and we need to be able to demystify them. Sophia Noble is our guest out of UCLA. I'm going to have you come back. We're going to have a richer
Anytime.
Conversation.
And I appreciate you.
No, we appreciate you. This is groundbreaking work. It's important work. Thank you. It's stuff that should not be taken for granted. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio, folks. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Dadaman. Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else? Just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock. Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat it and from the steel grave, you say, please. Maybe it'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say, peace to the lovers I made with a piece. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, we need David G.
Real Talk Radio. You and I rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, South, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Pop, Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. Yo, and to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop.